Friends, and welcome back to our continuation of the work with the six stages of discipleship. Now, the segue for us here from program, I think it's program 15, and we're heading into Program 16, yes. It's a little segue the master of an ashram and the senior initiates. Remember, senior initiates are those beyond the third degree, and initiate is one of the third degree. The master of an ashram and the senior initiates in his group are responsible for the relation between Shambhala and hierarchy. And remember that there is established a very conscious relation with the monad at the fourth initiation. That doesn't mean that one's center of consciousness is focused on the monadic plane, but still at that point, the influence of the monad is deeply recognized and considered. Accepted disciples and the lesser initiates are responsible for the relation between the hierarchy and humanity. Well, you know, think of the accepted disciples as members of, some of them, as members of the new group of world servers and highly placed in the new group of world servers and occupying the, therefore the Ajna center of the new group of world servers. Hierarchy is the heart, and humanity, from certain perspectives, is the throat. Okay, so we can see where our role as accepted disciples, if we achieve that, would be to somehow mediate between what we can receive from hierarchy, who receives it from Shambhala, what we can mediate to humanity that is open to that kind of energy. And thus, synthetically, as DK says, thus the great chain of the hierarchy of being is preserved inviolate. That's, of course, that's what we want to see, that continuity of energy, even though it becomes necessarily stepped down on the way down so that it can be applicable, received and applicable to such as we are, and then, of course, such as average, even non-aspiring humanity also is. Now, we're on part six, and we're looking at the stage of accepted discipleship. This is program number 16, and we're beginning on page 732. In this particular program, we're not going to be able to do the entire nine pages. No way, because we have some activities tonight, some broadcasts in the ASK program, which features within it some of the meditations which Master DK said to do once a week. And tonight is the attracting financial resources for the work of the hierarchy. Other things he suggested to do every day, and that is the triangle's work to keep that network illuminatively, lovingly alive. Okay, going on a little bit here, and it is not my intention in this short series of instructions to deal with the stage of accepted discipleship. Much has been written about this stage. I've covered every practical angle in my many books. Maybe there are other angles that have not been covered, but the practical ones, yes. And there is nothing to be gained by duplication, except in another sense, there is something to be gained by judicious, well-placed repetition. Okay. But whatever the Tibetan gives, it's of considerable value and really more than we can ever assimilate. That's pretty clear. The books on discipleship put out by the Theosophical Society adequately cover the probationary path. I have dealt in detail with the path of discipleship. And basically, he is distinguishing somehow between the probationary path and the true path of discipleship. These different phases have quite a fluid application. And we have to understand the context in which they are used. True discipleship, we might say, begins with the path of accepted discipleship sometime between the first and second initiation, usually. From another perspective, when you become an initiate of the first degree, you are a true aspirant and also, in a sense, a disciple who is accepting the things which the teacher details to you, and have made your pledge. The pledge is always coming before acceptance is possible. The angle of the contact which becomes possible upon the path of accepted discipleship, the third phase of these six or seven phases, are well known, but cannot be described in too much detail. To do so apparently would lead to error, because why? As he goes on and says, they vary according to person and ray. So we can't have every person on every ray covered, generalizing that what DK says about that path definitely applies to them, because there may be individual modifications. I would ask you to have these modes of approach in mind, remembering that they do occur and occur in varying degrees of clarity and at various stages upon the path. And this is the path of accepted. Accepted discipleship. Okay. I think a lot of people might wonder why we take such pains over certain technicalities, but the technicalities of the occult path, they are in the last analysis important for real clarity of understanding. So he's mentioned these in various places, I think. And now we're going more into detail. We have the possibility of a dream experience, number one. A symbolic teaching, number two. These are, we might say, modes of approach, right? The thought form of a master. And these are either created by the master or, well, there certainly are thought forms which unfortunately give off fairly erroneous teaching. As he calls it, good words of mediocre cheer, the kind of attaboy support. You're doing great, you know, applause. No. If a thought form of a master or the apparent presence of a master starts talking like that, well, you have to discount it as merely a form created by wishful thinking. Then, of course, number four, a direct contact with the master in meditation. And that has to be different from the thought form itself. And then, because, I mean, for him to take the time to do that, you know, it's not that we are so necessarily worthy of a lot of the master's attention at first. And then an interview in the master's ashram. Roberto Azzagioli was not only a accepted disciple, he was an initiated disciple. And yet the Tibetan had to remind him of a very important and detailed interview that he had had apparently during the hours of sleep with his master, Master K.H. He was helping the Tibetan, of course, but his true master was Master Kutumi. And apparently, Dr. Azzagioli had forgotten the interview, or at least the deep substance of the interview, which seemed to indicate the way towards becoming a true world savior and taking the fourth degree. So you can see how important the substance was. And you can also see that even very high disciples, who are also initiates, as he was, can forget. Now, the first three modes of approach, or let's call it not only a mode of approach of the disciple to the master, but the master's mode of approach to the becoming accepted disciple. The first three are more usually the experience of the probationary disciple. This dream, symbolic teaching, thought form of a master. The last two are undergone by the accepted disciple, and they have their lower or astral psychic counterparts. So he's trying to help us distinguish between the value of what we may encounter that indicates to us some kind of developing new relation. They are, in this case, not all glamour and illusion, and are not basically reprehensible, for they are, in reality, the seed or guarantee of future inevitable experiences upon the way. People do see thought forms of the masters, get very excited about it sometimes too, you know, thinking, ah, well, this is in fact the presence of the master. They do see thought forms of the masters, for those thought forms exist. They do receive symbolic teachings upon the astral plane or in the dream states. Beginners and the inexperienced are then apt to do one of two things: overestimate the experience and believe it to indicate a high spiritual development, and they begin to lean upon the experience and to substitute this astral happening for the future reality, or they dismiss it as lower psychism, forgetting that so-called lower psychism is only when the interpretation and the use of the experience is at fault. So we have two methods of interpretation possible to us, both of which lead to error. It is the task of the accepted disciple to aid in the interpreting, to indicate direction, and to point out the significance of the experience to the neophyte. So this is definite teaching work that the more experienced disciple who has been through this and who is accepted owes, in a way, to those who are up and coming. I mean, it's difficult to get an accurate sober assessment of what has really happening, and to substitute that happening for the real thing in the future, that is a self gratifying response. So let's be cautious in this area. Workers in the spiritual field should bear this carefully in mind and remember that as the result of the war, Second World War, of tension and of aspiration towards the New Age, these dreams and visions, these episodes of symbolic teaching, these contacts with thought forms will steadily increase and are indicative of growth and expansion. See, he's taking the first three, which are, I raised the volume so high that would have been unbearable. So these three can be so easily misinterpreted, but they do represent a tendency, some kind of progress towards the real thing. Undirected, unexplained, and misunderstood, or laughed down and ridiculed, or quietly viewed in contempt, even if the listener doesn't say anything, they can greatly hinder and can be forced to descend into the category of true lower psychism. Rightly interpreted and explained, that's the clarity of the impartation is so important to promote the progress of the disciple. Rightly interpreted and explained, they can constitute a series of graded revelations upon the way of light. They exist then as guarantees of future knowledge and as signposts, and as signposts of a relative achievement, but they are not the reality when astrally focused. I guess when the mind is not sufficiently involved and the full faculties are not present. So let's be on the lookout within ourselves for these guarantees of future knowledge, and these indicators, these signposts of a relative achievement. And we're just being asked to have a proportional point of view, not to exaggerate or minimize. When we do that, glamour and illusion creep into the situation. So something of value is being indicated to the alert disciple who is able to, let's see, what have I got here? The alert disciple. I've got it now. Of who is able to either using the words of the Tibetan who does explain these things, or the words of someone who has gone through the process, like another accepted disciple, that these can be encouragements along the way. We just waste our time if we exaggerate the value of our spiritual, so-called, mostly astral, experiences. And if we interpret things in a way that lands them in the veil of illusion, then also we waste our time. And it's a long time before we wake up, you know. Let's see, what have I got here? Okay. We wake up sadder but wiser. We wake up realizing that we had thought something about ourselves which flattered our personality or impressed others with our so-called attainments. All to what end? No good end at all. I am reminded, you know, I've had a little bit of experience in all this, and I've met a number of people who swear up and down that they are a first-ray monad. It's always the flashing red lights go off when I hear these assertions. Because what it usually means, and it's a very humbling thing to realize it, is that their personality is on the first ray, and they are asserting that personality. It's not the real thing. You have to look for, you know, first ray monads in incarnation are, and especially in a relatively advanced or disciplic state of development, are very, very rare. First of all, there are fewer of them, and second of all, the bulk of them individualized relatively later in the process. We might say in Atlantean days. So they have not had a chance to develop those particular monadic potentials. But it's all people being in a hurry and wanting to ambitiously advance. The sense of proportion is missing. An adjusted sense of right proportion. And divine understanding. And there's one more. It defines harmlessness. It's passing through my mind, but look it up in the rules and laws of esoteric healing. Yes, a completed point of view. So that sense of proportion, a completed point of view, and divine understanding. No. Those qualities are not there yet. So it's not the reality when it is astrally focused. But as Master Kutumi has said, we are told, a few drops of rain do not make a monsoon, but they presage it. They foretell it. It is coming. So we won't mistake the presage for the absolute, for the thing in itself. Disciples need to bear in mind always that they grow by the answering of their own questions. I guess this is what it means to, as in white magic, inquire the way, the very first responsibility of the disciple on his way to eventually become an adept. They grow by the answering of their own questions. The task of the master is not to answer questions, which, given a little time and thought, the disciple could answer himself. I mean, we are taught how to become masters by learning some degree of mastery. So it goes back to the Buddha then, rely upon yourself. Back to his last sermon, rely upon yourself. Finally, but the task of the master is to suggest or throw into the disciple's mind the type of question which warrants his thought, and then to stimulate his abstract mind, interesting, so that he can successfully find the answer. That comes first, and you will recognize that stimulation of the abstract mind as related to the building of the antikarana, the inner organ, the rainbow bridge. This is, in a way, the first stop upon the projected path of antikarana building. And it may be that at our present stage of development, we never really reach the Buddhic permanent atom, or we never reach the atmic permanent atom, being on levels even beyond that which on which the master usually functions, but we can come on rapport with them if we learn how to project the antikarana. So we will emphasize this. Now, it's obvious, this idea that we have to rely upon ourselves. I guess it's obvious, but the master does not want to produce a bunch of dependents. Now, maybe in the past, family relationships involving the master and you and me have been that of a dependent upon the master. But more and more, we find that it will be possible to have some degree of confident self-reliance, at least the willingness to experiment concerning our self-reliance. Of course, when you really look at what self-reliance can finally mean, the Buddha says, rely upon yourselves. Well, who is that self? That's not only the personality self. It is something that takes us all the way into some very high places, very high points of tension, which are the self, the triad, the monads. Well, and then, you know, we could go on. So let us recognize a certain degree of a demanded independence as we tread this path. We're not here only to quote chapter and verse. I know I do it a lot, okay, but the Tibetan said this, the Tibetan said that, Jesus said this or that, Christ said this or that. Yes, these are very important things. But how much, asks the Tibetan, have we climbed the mountain of vision by ourselves? We have to have the will to do that by inquiring the way. You can see, therefore, says the Tibetan, how important the entire problem of questions can be. Mercury, right? The questioning planet. And how in a master's ashram or group, the responsiveness of the membership to the questions, registered either by the individual disciple or by the group as a whole, and the answering of these questions has a conditioning effect upon the group. An ashram, the state of consciousness of a spiritual group, and questions. The word quest is in there, of course, and it suggests further and further progress. And he's also told us that the ashram is not a place for long, silent meditations and so forth, but too often to discuss the important aspects of the spiritual life, and I suppose to have points of view in the answering of certain questions, which help the group as a whole reach some kind of reasonable consensus, even though the methods used by the individuals in their related service may be very different from each other. So, what do we have here? So our responsiveness, if we are members of the Master's Ashram, is tested out, and the group is affected by how we respond. It is here that the Master's particular work comes in, the arousing of the ashram to the asking of those questions, which will lead to revelation, because not all questions are worthy and profitable in that sense. A master has always two things to bear in mind: the group condition, which is dependent upon the aggregated vibration or note of all the members of the ashram, insofar as they work together. And secondly, the period in which the group is functioning. So there, is a master's duty, and especially here, it is the master's particular work, which comes in this way, the arousing of the ashram to the asking of those questions which will lead to revelation. Now, let's pause for a moment. Do you have any sense of questions that may have been thrown into your mind due to your affiliation with the master and his group or groups, which are of the type that will lead to revelation? Let's just pause for a moment and see if any of those kinds of questions are still retained in our consciousness. Just pause for a moment. Well, maybe it will take a little time to arrive at such questions, but questions around the essential are, of course, important. And questions around what the master really wants done in his ashram have a high revelatory value. Questions about the personnel, well, maybe they arise from a rather lower state, which is self-concerned and concerned with the personality aspect of others. So it takes a little probing, doesn't it, to get into the question of which questions lead where. Actually, you know, little piece of history, personal history here. I once had an occult bookstore called the Question Shop. I don't know these days why I chose that. It was a long time ago. But it was all about probing ever more deeply into the possibilities of revelation. Now, going on just a little, because this of necessity has to be a shorter program. So the group condition, that's what the master pays attention to. And he tells us, you are of interest to me according to your effect upon the group. And the period in which the group is functioning, because not all periods of history demand the same type of response from the ashram. To this must be added the total responsiveness of the entire ashram. Let's take a look at that. One of the difficulties confronting all ashrams, viewing them as wholes, is to absorb new members and disciples, either singly or in groups. It reminds me of early days, long ago, of Masonic induction. Usually the candidate would go through the intake ritual, that of the entered apprentice alone. But there, at the time I was entering back in 1974, there was a significant number of people who wanted to join. And so they were brought in groups of three, maybe sometimes four. And everybody had to know the responses, because each one of the inductees, the newly made initiates, had to respond when he was called upon. So he had to know the entire response that was required. It was a lot of memorization work. So anyway, it's a difficulty to absorb new members and disciples. And one question that necessarily arises is, how can a group within an ashram constituted of relatively new disciples and beginners on the path of accepted discipleship become increasingly sensitive to the vibration of the ashram as a whole, and of the master of the ashram? Well, it's always difficult to take new members into any kind of project. They have to learn the ropes, you know, as it were, borrowing a kind of image from the old sailing ships. Because disturbance can occur. This question, in reality, embodies the major problem existent between the personality and the soul, between the master and the disciple, between humanity and hierarchy. So it must be an important question, because we're always dealing with the adjustments of the higher and the lower. And there is much accommodation to be made when the lower, with difficulty, comes into the presence of the higher. Humanity, of course, right now, is going through that particular problem. It is basically a question of registering essential unity and the cessation of separativeness. Registering essential unity and the cessation of separativeness. Because you know, the discriminating mind is so active in so many disciples, separating this from that, where no basic or essential separation actually does exist. Disciples in their consciousness have to learn to avoid differentiating between aspects of the ashram, inner and outer, and between the few ashramic members whom they may know and the vast number who remain unknown to them. But, you know, we have the habit of this discriminating concrete mind, and we sort of drag it with us when we, even when we're standing on the periphery as a newly accepted disciple in the ashram. An ashram is one group or band of disciples, initiates of various degrees, world disciples, usually considered of the third degree or beyond, and neophytes at the very beginning of the way of discipleship. And this way of discipleship we're learning here is really the way of accepted discipleship. Disciples must not think in terms of different ashrams, but in terms of the ashram as a whole, the great ashram, which is directed by Sanatkumara. It is his group, in a way, and of it, the Christ is, well, he is the head and the heart in a certain way. And beyond it stands the great king. I realize my picture has taken an odd turn up here. And I'm in the shadow, and out of the shadow has to do with light coming into the big windows of the temple. So we have to set the usual tendencies of the concrete mind aside. Now, that can be very difficult for some types of very mentally focused aspirants and newly inducted disciples. We always have to watch out that the thing at which we are best in may be the very cause of glamour and illusion. We sometimes begin to pride ourselves on certain accomplishments only to discover we invest ourselves so thoroughly in a limited mode of approach, however useful in other ways, that we become trapped and cannot fully appreciate the secondary factor of unity, which must guide the ashram. Okay. So differentiation is something we have to avoid, and we have to keep that concrete mind in leash. Remember the new esoteric schools exist because the concrete mind in so many people is too well developed, too prominent, the astral body too unstable, the physical etheric body too weak. The new esoteric schools are meant to solve that particular condition. And who among us is to say that we don't need that solution? It's one band or group of disciples of a number of different strata, all the way from initiates of high degree to those who are just entering. Disciples must not think in terms of different ashrams, but in terms of the ashram as a whole. And that is a second ray kind of consideration of what the ashram really is. Well, we're getting there, folks. As I said, I can't have a long program this time because other programs are coming up. The key to this realization, little as you may think it, is intensity. Okay, this is a new occult fact that he is introducing. Intensity, or working from a point of tension, brings in the flood tide of revelation. And it is then possible for a disciple to learn in one short day what might otherwise take years, months, or even years to learn. Tension, when focused rightly, is a great releasing power. So many disciples focus tension wrongly and release energy in the wrong direction. And, if I might so inadequately express it, from the wrong location. I mean, there are chakras in our system with which people such as ourselves must not have too much to do. We cannot focus on them as if they are the center of our life. Right tension is brought about by first by correct orientation, and this necessitates a true sense of values and freedom from those minor preoccupations which produce extension instead of tension. If you are, to give a very usual illustration, preoccupied with your physical condition, you will not experience the tension which will make you a magnetic center of power and love. If you are preoccupied with the failures of other people or with their ideas about you, so one would be kind of a critical attitude and the other an unnecessarily sensitive attitude, which can be solved by the old saying, they say, what do they say? Let them say. You will again fail to experience the tension which releases. You would find it of value to discover where your extensions are. They are, you know, in a way, energy leaks, we might say, and then retreat inward to the point of tension from which you can consciously and effectively direct soul energy. Well, I think I'm going to pause here because a meditation which I must lead is coming up. So we're on really page 735. And we're working in the six stages of discipleship, especially accepted discipleship. So this has taken us to 735, and it is the 13th of June. Yes, I didn't get back to it last night the way I hoped I would. Sometimes it just happens. But now we're on a new subject, and it will make a good segue. This question of intensity. Let's see. The question of intensity and the flood tide of revelation. Okay. So we'll plunge right back into the middle of that particular subject. And we've covered just a few pages. And we'll begin with program 17 of the six stages of discipleship. And you know, I better not be too optimistic. Sometimes I'd like to say, well, I'll continue tonight, but it might not be the case at all. So this will, well, we have nine pages in this particular section. So even the next program, before discussing Chela on the Thread, will not probably be completed the remaining section on accepted discipleship will probably not be completed in any program I do next as program 17. Well, friends, look, thank you for being here. And I'm, you know, really trying hard to do at least one program a day. And sometimes it's possible and sometimes it's not. So let's keep studying. And thus, through application of the Tibetans' wise and detailed words, we will improve our discipleship usefulness. Lots of love from Tuya and me in the communications group, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.